May it please the court. Tony Axon. Good morning. Representing the appellant Wayne Pennell, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The sentencing court misunderstood the requirements of United States Sentencing Guidelines Section 5K2.13, and as a result, erred in ruling upon Mr. Pennell's motion for departure pursuant to that guideline provision. Under Section 5K2.13, to show diminished capacity, a defendant must show that he committed the offense while suffering from a significantly reduced mental capacity, and the significantly reduced mental capacity contributed substantially to commission of the offense. And the Sentencing Commission has defined a significantly reduced mental capacity as the significantly impaired ability to, one, understand the wrongfulness of the behavior comprising the offense, or to exercise reason, or to control behavior that the defendant knows is wrongful. And the district court in this case did not understand the requirements under the first prong, the first alternative prong, and as a result committed a mistake of law that in itself was an abuse of discretion and requires remand. The district court ruled that a departure, it started its analysis by ruling that a departure under Section 5K2.13 requires a showing that the defendant committed the offense when he could not understand the wrongfulness of the behavior.
Where did he say that?
He said that on the 1-5 transcript, page 152.
That's not a very direct quote, is it? What did he actually say, Mr. Axon?
Requires a showing that the defendant committed the offenses when he could not understand the wrongfulness of the behavior that comprised the offense.
Where on the page are you?
May I refer to?
Go ahead, right here. He said, I do not find that a substantial inability to understand the wrongfulness of behavior has been established. Is that not what he actually said?
Ultimately, the district court reached that. Yes, the district court did state that, but
he referred to a significantly impaired ability to understand the wrongfulness, right?
No, the district court never actually.
Look at the second line on page 152 to which you referred. With respect to the significantly impaired ability to understand the wrongfulness of his behavior, isn't that actually consistent with the standard under the rule?
I believe what the district court was referring to there was the argument that the defendant was making. The district court concluded that Mr. Pennell had not established a substantial inability to understand the wrongfulness of his behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that is.
And what is the standard of the rule? What is the standard that you say he's departing from by that? You stated it just a few minutes ago. State it again, please, the standard that you say the judge did not understand.
The district court didn't understand the difference between a defendant who could not understand the wrongfulness, and where the really operative language is could not, and a defendant who has a significantly impaired ability to understand the wrongfulness.
Well, what's the difference between a significantly impaired ability and a substantial inability to understand?
Well, a substantial.
In fact, the next line after that, he says, with regard to the inability or substantial, significantly impaired ability to exercise the power of reason. So he's using perhaps slightly different words than the rules, but would we not be elevating form way over substance to say he committed a reversible error by that?
No, I wouldn't say that you're elevating form over substance. He did not use the same language. But mental health really is a spectrum, and it goes from insanity at the worst end to completely sane. And the Section 5K2.13 has used very specific language. It has said significantly impaired. Substantial inability is not the same thing as significantly impaired. And the reason that I say that is substantial inability suggests that he cannot, could not do this. So on that spectrum, substantial inability suggests that an area on the spectrum closer to legal insanity, which, as the court knows, means that a defendant simply is unable
to. The reason of disease or defect of the mind is unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct. Or,
yeah. That's correct. So significant impairment suggests that there may be some mental deficiency lower on that spectrum. But whatever the phrase that the court used, also on page 152, the court said, Mr. Pinnell's failure to appreciate consequences does not diminish his fundamental understanding that threatening people is wrong. And that gives insight to exactly what the court was doing. That statement is wrong, and is actually the converse of what the court, how the court should be analyzing this. It's not that Mr. Pinnell needed to know the difference between right and wrong, as the court says in that statement. It's precisely that he doesn't understand the consequences that the court should be evaluating under this first prong of Section 5K2.13. I believe that the court didn't actually make factual findings in support of this conclusion. And that suggests that the court believed that Mr. Pinnell had somehow conceded that because he knew the difference between right and wrong. His expert testified that he does know the difference between right and wrong, or that he knows that making a threat is wrong. Because the court believed that Mr. Pinnell had conceded that in some way, the court appears to have believed that there was no way for Mr. Pinnell to prevail on that first prong, and therefore factual findings weren't necessary. The court also didn't make factual findings for the second part of the test, which is whether the significant impairments contributed substantially to commission the offense. And once again, as the court considered this analysis, it said, my reasoning is not based on the conclusion of mentally retarded. It's based on the elements set forth in 5K2.13 and the definitions of those. So that suggests that the court was perceiving some impairment on Mr. Pinnell's.
Whose burden is the impairment?
It was Mr. Pinnell's burden, yes, to show an impairment, yes. And Mr. Pinnell carried that burden. All of the evidence presented with regard to his mental health was presented by Mr. Pinnell.
Yeah, and the judge explained, did he not, why he was not giving full credit to that evidence. The evidence was all the testimony of one witness.
The testimony of one witness?
Yep. And he explained why he was not giving her testimony great weight. Did he not? He said she didn't do a thorough examination.
There were three factors that the court decided that she had not done a thorough examination on.
Mm-hmm. She had not met her own protocol. She testified as to the protocols on cross-examination that should be used in that evaluation. And in three of the things in the protocol, she had not done. Is that not correct?
She did testify that three of those things she hadn't done. She hadn't spoken with, and these were recommended protocol, but she also explained that there was nothing inconsistent about the information that she had gathered, and she had access to the PSR, which contained inferences that could be drawn about that information. The court never actually rejected Dr. Junta's findings, and Dr. Junta explained, or I guess the pertinent findings for diminished capacity. Dr. Junta explained that Mr. Pinnell couldn't reason that he had problems understanding the consequences of his actions. And it would be one thing if the court only dismissed on the second and third alternative prongs, but the court had a fundamental misunderstanding about the first prong, and that's what Dr. Junch's testimony went to.
Okay, we've taken you beyond your allotted time. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary. Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Mr. LaBar.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Joseph LaBar. I represent the United States in this matter. It is our position that the district court did not commit plain error of any sort in this case in the sentencing of Mr. Pinnell. Mr. Pinnell did not meet his burden before the district court, which was to show by a preponderance that he had committed his crimes while suffering a significantly reduced mental capacity, as that term is used within the sentencing guidelines. And we turn first, as did this court in its questions to my colleague, to the first prong, that is to say whether or not there was a significant impairment in his ability to understand the wrongfulness of his behavior. It is difficult, I would suggest respectfully, for my colleague to argue that a court can accept the testimony of a defense witness who says that the defendant actually understood that it was wrong to make threats, but nonetheless asked the district court to engage in analysis over, despite his actual knowledge of the wrongfulness of threats, whether he was somehow impaired in his ability to arrive at that correct conclusion, which is that threats are wrong. I would suggest to the court that the district court certainly did not commit plain error in that regard.
The second part of the test is a little broader, is it not? This question of whether the reduced capacity contributed substantially to the commission of the offense. So it's not focused exclusively on knowledge that it's wrong. Presumably anything else that might go towards commission of the offense is relevant, right?
Well, yes, sir. And Your Honor, I think the way this works and the way the guideline is structured is that first the court turns to whether or not any of those three prongs, really, that can undergird a finding that there's an impairment, whether any of those prongs have been satisfactorily demonstrated by a defendant, that is to say, to a preponderance. And then the court turns to the impact of that impairment if the court finds such an impairment. In the first instance, the court turns to the impact of that impairment on the commission of the offense that the court has before it for sentencing. Your Honor, in this case, the second of the three prongs was the defendant's ability to exercise the power of reason. The district court found that he had the ability to exercise the power of reason. The district court directly confronted, as it did in each of these prongs, directly confronted the testimony of the defendant's sole witness, the psychologist who testified that her conclusions were based in large measure on a 4.5-hour interview and the administration of a single test with an utter lack of investigation or interview into the people who could have provided valuable information. The second prong, again, being the ability to exercise the power of reason, the court directly confronted what the doctor said in that regard. The court said that Dr. Guinta based her conclusion in that regard on the defendant's perceived inability to generate a more effective and or lawful and or benign solution to his problem, his desire not to testify. And Dr. Guinta said that the defendant was incapable of generating other options. The court did not find that credible. The court comments at page 152 of the transcript of that date that Dr. Guinta's testimony that the defendant failure, and I'm not quoting, Your Honor, I'm paraphrasing, Dr. Guinta's finding that the defendant failed to generate options didn't mean that he was incapable of generating options. And the court actually pointed out that options had been presented to Mr. Pinnell that did not involve what the court would subsequently and rightly characterize as vile threats against a public servant. That the public servant in question, Deborah Sines, had offered the opportunity for protection, that the defendant had served for a considerable period of time, roughly 5 years, as an informant. Yes, sir.
You're coming to sealed material in the brief that I think should remain sealed.
Yes, sir. I'll move on.
Let's not bring that out in open court, please.
Let me then state simply that the court pointed out a number of other available, lawful, and effective options that the defendant clearly was aware of and chose not to exercise. And so the court dismissed Dr. Guinta's conclusion in regard to the impaired ability to exercise the power of reason based on the rationale that she provided to the court. The court then turned to the other prong, the third prong, which is an inability to control behavior, and quite rightly, the court looked to the record of the behavior in this case, of the threats in this case. The court had heard trial testimony that the defendant had planned the threats, that the defendant had recruited someone to execute the threats. He had paid them in cocaine and food. He had told them what to say, that the two threateners, the defendant and his cohort, had used not one but two phones. They weren't cell phones. They were pay telephones. That the threat that was made was a threat that had its basis in information the defendant had received in casual conversation with Ms. Sines. And again, because it might touch into some sealed area, I'll simply be oblique and say that the threat was tailored to Ms. Sines' family situation, and that the person who, of course, knew of that was Mr. Pinnell from a family situation, from a conversation that she and he had had about the burdens of raising a family in the district. The court doubtless was also impressed by the fact that Mr. Pinnell was able, in the eve of the threats, when Ms. Sines, according to the trial record, heard the threat, she called a police officer, and again, I'll be somewhat oblique, and Mr. Pinnell took that opportunity to get on a telephone and reinforce the threats by saying, you know, I heard that somebody's watching your office and so forth and so on. The trial court heard testimony from Ms. Sines that the next day or in the days that followed, Mr. Pinnell had been in Ms. Sines' office. And Mr. Pinnell had again taken the opportunity, again, to reinforce those threats, saying that he had heard some nefarious activity at a recreation center of some sort, so that the court was very, well advised to look at the ability to exercise the power of reason, the ability to control behavior in a case that's carried out in this fashion, so that these were not a simple set of threats. And so when the court finally did, Your Honor, reach the question of whether or not there was a significant contribution, what really was left for the court to do? The court had already rightly found that the defendant had met his burden, had not demonstrated a significant impairment, so that the court then said that to the extent that any impairment at all had been demonstrated, that the court didn't feel that the impairment had impacted the commission of this offense. And again, that is certainly not clear error. There's certainly nothing about that that should be found by this court to be clear error. Your Honor, my colleague argues also that the court failed to provide sufficient factual undergirding for its conclusions such that this court can review it. The government disagrees with that. The government believes that the district court provided this court with ample reason, ample explanation, certainly followed the dictates of Rita and the cases that followed Rita. That the court was not required to refute each and every point that was raised by a defense witness. The court certainly did not have to shift the burden. In other words, when Mr. Pinnell chose to present his sole witness on this issue and that sole witness gave her conclusions, it was not then incumbent upon the court to treat it as if a prima facie case had been made and the burden had then shifted either to the court to explain why it wasn't made out or to the government to refute it. Lastly, my colleague argues in his brief that the sentence was unreasonable based upon a perceived lack of adequate explanation for the court's rationale undergirding the sentence. We disagree with that, of course. We believe that under 3553, the court went through a very thorough and detailed explanation of its sentence. Lastly, that claim, Your Honor, by my friend, again, comes back to what I think perhaps is the underpinning of a great deal of Mr. Pinnell's argument, which is his disappointment in the fact that his sole witness was insufficient to meet his burden at the sentencing. And I think that what undergirds his argument to a certain extent is a belief that somehow the district court was required to accept that testimony, and it simply was not. Your Honor, I'd be glad to respond to any questions the court might have.
Seeing none. Thank you. We'll hear from the defense in rebuttal and give you back 2 minutes.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Pinnell does not advance the position that the court was required to accept the findings of his expert, but the court was required to apply the rule of lenity, and this was a sentencing hearing at which Mr. Pinnell had to show by a preponderance of the evidence that he suffered from diminished mental capacity. The government persists with the incorrect view that because Mr. Pinnell conceded that he knew that a threat was wrong, in the abstract sense, a threat is wrong, he understood that rule, that he therefore necessarily understood the consequences of the threat in this case.
He would have to show a connection between an impairment and the commission of the offense, wouldn't he? The record reveals that he knew it was wrong. What is the evidence that should have convinced the judge that there was a connection between an impairment and the commission of a very serious crime?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Pinnell was in a difficult predicament in this case, and this was not a predicament of his own creating. He didn't want
to
testify.
You're getting rather far from my question to you, counsel.
Well, to go directly to your question, the evidence is, I guess, intertwined in this case because of his mental deficiencies. It's difficult to understand why he would pursue this course of action. One, when, as the government says, there were other options available to him. But I hate to get far from your question, but Mr. Pinnell does not have the skills to negotiate this type of situation. It's precisely because he doesn't have the skills to negotiate this type of situation that his mental deficiency contributed to this offense. There may be other offenses that Mr. Pinnell could commit or would commit that his mental deficiencies don't contribute to, because it's not a situation that requires subtlety or thinking through the next step, thinking through the consequences. For example, he can understand a simple rule that selling drugs is wrong. So every time you sell drugs, it's wrong. In this case, we keep on talking about the threat as though the threat is only a threat. This is not only a threat. This is not a simple case of threats. A simple threat would be, I'm going to kill you. This is a case of a threat against a federal official that has a whole host of other consequences that
you've actually gone well beyond your time again, counsel. So thank you, and the case is submitted.